Embedding Lived Experience in Scotland is a programme led by Safe Lives, Improvement Service and Resilience Learning Partnership, in partnership with survivors of domestic abuse and trauma, and funded by the Scottish Government.
It aims to ensure survivors' voices influence and shape services, systems and pathways in ways that are safe, meaningful and trauma-informed.
You may hear the terms survivor, lived experience and expert by experience. For this podcast series, we have chosen to let people use the language that best fits their own experience and viewpoint, rather than restrict to one agreed term.
While this project was rooted in violence against women and girls work, we believe that these themes and questions are relevant for anyone seeking to embed lived experience work across all sectors and policy areas.
So welcome to our third podcast series in the Authentic Voice project. I am joined today by the amazing Karen McCluskey and the amazing Emma Wilson, both, in my eyes, very strong female leaders in the criminal justice sector. I suppose you work in slightly different areas. Karen, you're very high level, strategic, responsible for a very important organisation in Scotland, and Emma, you're out there doing the operation stuff within criminal justice, and both of your organisations are, I think, really significant in what we want to talk about today. So I don't want to rattle on and talk loads. I would love you guys to kind of introduce yourselves and tell us a wee bit about what you do now, your current role, but how, what led you there as well, how you got there. I hope through that can share some of the role that lived experience has played in that, doing lived experience work and listening to lived experience work, listening to lived experience and your roles as well. So Karen, let's start with you, if that's all right. Tell us a wee bit about...
I mean, we're near International Women's Day, so it's quite nice to have three women, and there's a great programme tomorrow, which is, in fact, it's on tonight, which is about the women who changed modern Scotland, and about just how important women, ordinary women, have been in changing the lives of so many people, you know, that we come in contact with every day. So my background is, I sort of speak about it, so I trained as a nurse. Pretty poor, although I still love wounds and love emergency rooms, and it's my favourite place to be. And then trained as a psychologist, did a degree in psychology, and went abroad, worked in East Africa. Then did what's called investigative psychology. So I've trained a bit further doing investigative psychology, which was really about the psychology of crime and about investigation, etc. And I went into the police and spent the next 20-odd years in various police services, mainly in intelligence, but in the investigation of crime, and, you know, looking at, I mean, a whole range from quite volume crime to some of the more serious things in terms of murders and, you know, child sexual abuse and some really terrible, terrible offences. But my latterly, I came up to Scotland and I set up the Violence Reduction Unit in a response to what was pretty much an epidemic of violence. And using a public health model, so trying to think, well, we've tried to police our way out of this, what else can we do? How do we turn it on its head? How do we look at prevention? Because it is the most important thing that we all do. It's not about trying to deal with people when they've fallen off the cliff, but how do you build that barrier at the top? And try and help people not get to that point and get people into well-being and making good decisions about their life and feel fulfilled and be the best they can be.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. I can listen to you talking all day. I can't wait for this podcast to kick off. Emma?
Yeah, and not quite as a diverse background as yourself. My whole career has been with Apex. So Apex is a national justice charity, which means we exist to support people who have experience of the justice system or at risk of entering it. I studied criminology at university. It's one of these things, you know, in terms of your area of passion, I always term it, you have a heart for a particular people, and mine always was. I wanted to work with people who had experienced the justice system. I wouldn't say I don't have direct lived experience of the system myself, but through some kind of personal interactions and with siblings and things like that, I just always had a heart for males in particular, and that awareness of people's environment and circumstances and how you end up where you end up. So moved to Scotland, University of Stirling, and knew who Apex was, wanted to work for Apex, and I did, made that my goal. So started with Apex in 2008 as a frontline practitioner, and this is me fast forward X amount of years later, and I'm director of operations. So my role has always been really in service delivery. That's who we are, obviously, as an organisation. Every role I've had, I guess, has propelled me to want to be more involved more strategically. Service provision and in communities is something I'm really passionate about, and people's experiences are at the heart of it. I don't think you always get the opportunity that you would like in day to day in terms of service provision, in that you're caught up in the agenda of contracts and performance and all this kind of world, but we'll go on to some of that, I'm sure. So I think it's about having an impact, isn't it? It's about wanting to work in a space where you can actually infiltrate people's lives. And so my day-to-day, obviously overseeing national operations, so we're all over the country, really diverse service provision, some directly within justice, some more kind of employability orientated. I think that's me.
Brilliant. And you both touched on it a wee bit there, and Karen, I would be dead interested to know from you kind of the role that lived experience played in something like setting up the VRU. Yeah. So many people who'll be listening to this podcast will know the VRU's work, but what role did lived experience play in that, and could you have done it with it lived experience?
Oh God, no. I mean, I've never been a 16-year-old boy. I've never been in the jail. I've never been arrested by the police, at least not yet. Do you know, and it's really strange, I mean, we talk about that phrase, lived experience, that's not how I didn't even know that phrase. We did it because it was the right thing to do. And because, you know, we were overwhelmed by levels of violence, and we had violence out in areas that I didn't live in, I wasn't from. And we needed to have people who could speak authentically and who understood it at a really granular level. Because there was a science to it as well. As so we talk about, like in public health, the first part is surveillance, knowing what you're looking at. Unless you've got people around you that have actually experienced and say, well, I actually can, I know you think this is it, but let me tell you what's really happening. You know, and then we had obviously people in the hospitals, and oh, we've got navigators now. And then things like all the risk and protective factors. Well, we needed people to tell us that as well, because I could look at books and I could look at papers and look at abroad, but I needed people to tell me, look, this is why we think it's happening. And I would have said 90% of the time they were pretty right. And then about what worked. And, you know, we could look at, you know, different models across the world, really. But we used to have people involved who'd been there, who'd experienced it and come out the other side, and they would say, Karen, that'll not work. You know, I mean, there was a huge amount of drive-by feedback, like, you're an idiot, that'll never work. But it was good, and Martin, as a guy that was in the Church of Scotland, Martin Johnson, I don't know whether people will know me, you know, he did a huge amount of work in the faith community in Glasgow, and he'd done that phrase, which I always get wrong, and I'm about to get wrong now, which is about nothing about us without us is for us. And I think that is the most important thing that went through all the VRU work, was because we always used to go to people and we'd say, here's a list of services, which one do you want? They would say, well, none of them actually fit what I need. And I need this. I need something completely different. And of course we would say, well, we don't have that, so we just go away and leave them. And so we had to design stuff that met people's needs, that allowed them to think. It's going to be a difficult phrase about, because we always talk about reducing reoffending, and it wasn't that. It was about, people would say, I just want to be happy. I would say, what does that feel like? And they would say, oh, I can't really explain it. because they'd never really been happy. So didn't really know what well-being felt like. Yeah. Didn't you know what it was like to have that life that was predictable and understandable, to have a sense of hope, to be surrounded by people who are supportive of you and where chaos wasn't just, you know, what's like the status quo. And so it was really interesting. I learned more from the people who'd been there than they ever learned from me. You know, and I'm so blessed really in many ways to have had so many people come across my door who were just amazing. And I always think I've got a human cloning list of people who have often done some serious time inside prisons, who've come out, changed their lives, and in doing so have changed everybody else's lives. And they know who they are because I'm contacting them all the time. So I couldn't have done it without it. And, you know, I think, I mean, obviously I'm involved in lots of third sector, Simon community in terms of homelessness. So we've had experience who've people who've experienced homelessness and who then try and redesign services. It's the same with Medics Against Violence. You know, we've got people who are coming into the emergency rooms and we design it around them. We, you know, and we fix it whilst it's moving.
Absolutely. And I think that's really the space we're starting to go into now. The AV project is, the whole purpose of it is about, it's about embedding lived experience within local authorities. Mm-hmm. That's why Improvement Service are involved in it. They seem to be particularly struggling in this area about how they embed lived experience and listen to it in a more authentic way and then take that listening and actually implement it into service design and delivery. And I'm finding as well a lot of third sector organisations are now starting to ask that question of how we include lived experience, because actually a lot of third sector organisations weren't set up on lived experience. They're set up on that thing you said earlier, what people think people need or hope that they need or think that they can give them and think that they can help. It's all been very well intentioned, but I suppose the landscape's really starting to change now, because so many of the people that you will have interacted with as well, Karen, they've transformed their lives. They've gotten in touch with education. They're now working in the sector. They're peer support coordinators. Some of them are chief execs of organisations.
Absolutely. Some of them are leading. They're leading organisations.
Absolutely.
Which is the way it should be. That's when you know it's working. When people who have experienced it reach that level, yeah, where they can influence so many other things. It's not enough just to employ people. It's a great thing, and I've always done it. But your job is to try and encourage and support them to step up and lead organisations and to be in the place that I am.
Absolutely, absolutely, because that's how we get that insight in it, and services designed in that way. Mm-hmm.
And that's it. I think the authenticity bit is key, isn't it? And just that sense of, I think there's an understanding of the terminology, but it's getting it that it's paramount. It's what you need to prioritise. It's above all else. And that, to quote yourself, Shamila, it's a journey, not a destination. And that can be a really uncomfortable place to be in terms of, so again, my kind of perspective, and as a service provision organization, you aren't in control, I guess, a lot of the time in terms of your operations. So how your business model operates, where your funding comes from, the whole environment that allows you to survive, so much of that is dictated by, as we've been talking about, what we think people need. And it's a brave place to need to be, where you can say you're in a place of constant evolution and that you need to react and change in the little, minute, intricate details as you learn and you evolve. I think, again, my biggest experience so far in a leadership context in terms of trying to embed trauma-informed practice, you know, that even that it's a rehearsed sentence now, isn't it? Which we don't want it to be. We would need to make sure that the meaning is infiltrated. But we're used to making decisions. You're used to needing to find solutions. And a lot of skill set kicks in, which can actually be a barrier to allowing change to happen. Sometimes you don't know how you're going to do it. You don't need to know. You have to allow yourself the space to be uncomfortable in the change happening. And I think that's maybe one of the biggest challenges in allowing, I understand this topic, I identify with it, but it sounds like it's going to be really hard to do. And what will it look like when it's done? There's an awful lot of practical implementation requirements, isn't there? But that doesn't mean... So it's pushing discomfort. And I guess if nothing else, that's what the third sector should be able to do.
I mean, I think as we go forward and into real budget cuts, I think actually the voice of lived experience is going to have to be more important.
Yeah.
Because I think we're spending money on stuff that people don't want and don't need. And see if we just ask them. Because people are the best diagnostician of their own condition. See if you say, what is it you need? Yeah. They'll probably tell you. Yeah. But we don't like to do that, do we? Just in case they make us uncomfortable and, you know, and they ask for something we don't have. And I remember speaking to a mum who had a huge amount of challenges, and her kids. And I remember saying to her, what's it about to help you? And she says, I just need to help somebody to help me clean the house. Because that was a bit, because the chaos, you know that bit, and we've all had it, the chaos overwhelms you, you think, oh God, you know, I can't see the wood for the trees. And that was all she needed.
Yeah.
It had cost us hee-haw money, frankly. And yet we were over an engineer in this big, you know, we need to do this and that, and she needs all this. And actually what she wanted was somebody to help her clean the house and keep it tidy so she could get the kids out to school.
Absolutely.
And so it's really interesting, isn't it? But sometimes that's quite discombobulating, isn't it? Mm. It sort of rubs with us because you think, well, hang on, I'm the expert here. Are you though? You know? Mm. Other people are the experts.
Absolutely. There's another story that I learned last year from, there's a new kind of approach happening in Northumbria, mm-hmm. where the statutory services have come together and they've rebranded it as well. So it doesn't even look like statutory services when you look at the website and stuff. And it's people from health and social care and the local authority working with people who are really in crisis. And there was a woman who, you know, all the professionals around the table couldn't work it out. Why is she not going to this appointment? Why could she not make this? We've set this up, that up. The woman didn't need to have a jacket. She needed a jacket. That's what she needed. And when somebody took the time to ask her, she told them, I'm freezing, I've not got a jacket to go, so I can't go when it's raining. I can't go and make appointments or go and jump the bus or whatever. And they got her a jacket, something so simple that costs absolutely nothing, just literally through asking. And there's an amazing story as well for here in Clax, for one of the primary schools where... you know, a full wall with the classroom was window, and it was exposed, and it was in the primary one classroom. And no matter what teacher took this class every year, they couldn't keep it in check. And the most experienced teacher to the least experienced teacher, nobody could work out what was going on in this class. And then somebody had the bright idea of asking the kids, and they found out very quickly that because the window was exposed, every time a parent walked by to go to the nursery, which was attached, the wains would jump out of their wee window of tolerance. They thought it was home time, or they thought it was their mummy coming, or, you know, got them thinking about their mummy or their daddy or whatever it was. And nobody for years knew this in this school. And it was dead simple. They put up loads of lovely colourful pictures that the kids done on the window to a certain height, and the kids would no longer see who was walking past.
In fairness, that's how I feel at work. I'm more distracted.
And you get some pictures up. But it's just that thing about you don't know until you ask. And actually a lot of people are really not used to asking what people need in their roles. That's that kind of power dynamic thing that...
Well, it's professionalism. You're called a professional.
Yeah.
Mm. Professional in what though? I mean, you have this, you know, you have education and then you're put into a skilled role. But actually, and so people want... You're right, it's about that power dynamic. You're deciding for people as opposed to helping with them, you know, and asking.
And people won't often challenge or question, and we find as well, many of the people we work with, they won't have the words to use yet. Mm-hmm. They often can't articulate what they want to say without getting upset or mm-hmm. not being able to regulate, and that then is often misconstrued, misunderstood by the professional in the space. I've just come from presenting at an adult support and protection conference and really talking about that stuff you said, Karen, that only people with lived experience can I share. So I was trying to help them understand what it's like when you've got letters coming through the door all the time. And if you're poor on benefits, you don't work, you're in the depths of addiction, you're in a domestically abusive relationship, there's no good mail coming through the door. I ignored everything that came through my door, and I was telling them that I'd put it in the bin. Unless it was a gyro, I wasn't opening it, and you knew what that was. It was in a brown envelope. And that was like my frame of mind. And you can see people starting to think and go, God, I actually didn't realise that. We send out loads of letters to people we're not realising.
Or they can't read. Yeah. You know, and I it's so surprising because we teach kids to read about to primary three or four, and then in a way we expect them to read. And the kids that can't then start to cause challenges because they can't read. So they act up, you know, that to distract. And then get excluded, and then it goes on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And that's a real challenge. And I meet people, adults, and so many of them have got no reading age. So when they get a letter, it's a stress reaction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And actually what they need is somebody to speak to them. So, I mean, the amount of people that we get who don't turn up at court, because we send them a letter about court date, well, one, they don't have a diary. Two, you know, they don't have a PA. And sometimes they're not able to understand the letter. It's not as if they can't calendar on the wall. So it's really, you have to see people as they are and not as you are.
Mm-hmm.
I think to be able to meet their needs.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've come across it quite a lot in our line of work, I suppose, that no matter how excellent the professional is, when it comes to a service being offered, you can forget about the person's their needs and their personal set and the fact, well, you're the same as everybody else, that you've got kids to drop off to school, as you say, the shopping to go and get, and that same kind of thing has come up quite a lot with the appointment cards. And could you manage seven different appointments with seven different people in different locations every week? And just that, you know, that people are people and they have their own lives to go about, you know, and it's not shoehorned into focused on the negative experience. Really, that's not at the forefront, is it?
No, absolutely. And we always say to people as well, like, so some services might only see someone for 1 hour a week, and you're trying to help people understand you're like a tiny wee thing in somebody's life, but you might be that one thing that's keeping them from getting their benefits sanctioned or going back to prison or being put in a more restrictive order or something like that. But knowing that in the grand scale of things, but that might seem like, you know, the whole world to the professional because they've got to get somebody through a programme or compliance or whatever it may be. Yeah, absolutely. And we're kind of touching on barriers a wee bit, and I'd love to talk about that a wee bit around what barriers do you think still really exist, especially at like a local government level, and starting to do some things differently, you know, and take a bit of a different approach and the expectations we have of people, you know, just even things like the amount of papers that people are expected to read if they've got to go to a children's panel, for example. I used to be an advocate and I struggled to get through all the papers that I had to read, you know, and also assuming, again, literacy levels, but also assuming people understand the terminology, people understand like what an actual child protection order is, what it means. I've sat in panels with mothers where they're literally just finding it in the panel, what that actually means. But you have another professional saying, oh no, mum read the report, I sent it to her 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Mum couldn't read. Mum doesn't know what all these words mean, you know, so she actually doesn't understand that she can't take her daughter away from here today, for example, which is an actual example of that coming out across the table in a panel rather than somebody having that information before. So for me, that's some of the bigger barriers are how systemised everything is, how bureaucratic it is. And like for another terrible example is a young mother we were supporting who had her children removed, and I went along to a meeting with her to advocate for her, which I shouldn't have really been doing in my role, but there was nobody else available, and we're not even an advocacy service, but she needed the support. And she came to that meeting through loudspeaker on my phone where I had it underneath my computer. That was the only way we could get her into the meeting. And there was 8 social workers in that meeting, and not one of those professionals had facilitated or helped make that happen. It's another big issue. You know, we're all moved into this kind of technologically advanced space now with the pandemic, with Teams and all of that. How do we bring people along with us in that, especially, you know, it's dead worrying to me, that one, you know, because it seems to be getting more and more bureaucratic.
It's what's easier for us, in a way, as professionals, isn't it? It's just what's easier for people, and, you know, and maybe I'm just too old now, but human beings are fundamentally connected, you know, and actually sitting in a room, picking up non-verbal communication, understanding, you know, as Darren McGarvey would say, picking up the intellect between the words is really important. And whilst it might be nice to sit in your house and do Teams calls because you're still in your jammies, it's not quite so good for the people at the other end who you only see for the bottom up or the top up and might be living in utter chaos, but you can't pick it up because that's all you're seeing. Mm. It's a very one-dimensional view of life. I mean, I'm quite hopeful. I see things changing. I do. And I try and always be glass half full because I think it's important, because I think we're so very Calvinistic in Scotland, you know, that, oh, it's miserable and it's going to rain and it's terrible. And yet there's some really good things going on. And I'm just going to mention my colleagues in the Simon community who I did a bit of work with, who had people who were on the streets and who were very difficult to house because of their alcoholism. And catastrophic, you know, problems with addiction around alcohol, couldn't go into housing first, so they thought, what else could this look like? Tried to involve them, knew that these men didn't want to stop, so bought a place for £1, did it up, made it look good, it was really nice, and then brought people in once at a time, and then gave them a managed dose of alcohol every hour.
I've seen this on the news recently.
So it took us about 2.5 years. The people in the Simon group were fantastic because lots of them had been there, had experienced it in their own families or had experienced it themselves, understood the drive of addiction.
Yeah.
And that actually, you can't punish somebody out of addiction. You can't tell them, you just need to stop drinking. You actually need to develop that agency yourself and be facilitated and supported to make decisions about your life. And they've done that, and I'm so impressed that they've listened to the men. They didn't come up with a fixed idea of what this should look like. They asked people, continuous improvement. Tell me, is this meeting your needs? Is there anything else you would like to do? You know, is this fitting in with how you thought it was going to go? How do you feel about yourself? And it's fascinating what's emerged.
Yeah.
People are taking care of themselves. People who've never taken care of themselves. You know, they're taking their Pabronex, their vitamin B12, because other people are caring for them, so they care for themselves.
And they have a solid base as well.
And they have a solid base. Somebody is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You've got some place that's warm, that's comfortable, where you're well fed, where people genuinely care about you, care whether you live or die.
Yeah. And it's like what they did in, what Gabor Maté did in Canada, where they had their centre where there was a rehab facility and all of that, but everybody had these, you know, like studio apartments. But even if people fell out of recovery, if they even started low level offending again, they wouldn't put them out. They kept them in. Because how are you meant to recover, or, you know, even if you fall off the wagon, how are you meant to get, you know, back into recovery if you don't even have a bed to sleep in at night?
And I think that is a thread that goes through loads of agencies. I mean, I know I've got teachers, and you know that I slightly love my primary school teachers. And I know so many of them that try and include kids when they're trying to be excluded. Yeah. Because they know that it's a response, and it's really difficult because people say, oh, but disrupt them in classrooms, etc. But they use things like nurture rooms, etc. So they are really understanding lots of things that you talk about, trauma and being trauma aware and you know, putting in mechanisms to meet children's needs in a different way.
Yeah.
And that's part of the learning experience, which I think is lovely. And I see lots of third sector doing it. I mean, Apex are doing it, and others are doing it across the country. So whilst things aren't there yet, there's a lot of real green shoots of some pretty phenomenal stuff.
So what do you think then that local authorities can learn from what others in the sector are doing, I suppose? Or what's their part in this? What can they do in this?
It's massive, isn't it? You know, again, back to our world, but the sector, third sector, more generally, you don't work in isolation. You work as a fully integrated part of local authorities and public services. And I really agree with what you were saying there, Karen, in terms of there is a tide of change, I think. And I had one really good conversation recently with a social work service manager. And he said back to me, he was really talking about what they're doing around multidisciplinary working, integration of lived experience, voice. But what he said back was, you know, it's just not good enough anymore. It's not good enough to just, in a compliance context, if someone's serving a community payback order, well, they didn't turn up. They're not likely to turn up. You know, this low expectation bar, what are you doing about it? And I really liked, you know, someone in that position. Just, we don't always, I think there's a bravery that is required within that context, because we know that social work teams are so up against it resource-wise, and it's compliance-driven, aren't they, in terms of statutory requirements. So it was really nice to hear someone pushing that impact, actually, and what we're achieving for people is paramount. It's not good enough anymore. And I guess it's back to what we were speaking about before, a bit of that bravery needing to be taken through. You know, there's so much illogical practice. There's no other word for it. We're excellent at our theory. We're excellent at, we understand the evidence base. You know, some of the stuff we're talking about, we should not be dealing with barriers where we're issuing constantly stuff on paper and people are illiterate. That's been brought up a couple of times today in different contexts. That's just an absolute nonsense. Of course we know that a soft word that takes 3 minutes, 5 minutes of a little bit of a handover before we're going into a set and a reassuring word, here's what to expect, I'll be here. And, you know, just that, we know ourselves, if you're walking into an environment that you're worried about, it could be a medical appointment, it could be anything, that your anxieties are up, and it just needs someone or something that brings that anxiety right down. And we can't keep blaming people for their non-engagement, their non-compliance, and whatever the context might be, whether it's a children's hearing or whether it's serving a community payback order. This is not rocket science stuff. Some of this, you're just, you know, you're going against the tide if we don't embrace those aspects of practice. Surely that's all in an approach.
Absolutely, yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think one of the things we're interested in, we're always thinking about doing a new project here at RLP, but something that we learn so much from the people who come here and engage, and especially from our tier participants, because Karen, you're right, there is some amazing stuff going on, and I'm normally the dead optimistic glass half full voice in any room around this stuff. But what we are even finding is, even though we can do some amazing stuff with people and we can help them get onto a pathway of growth and recovery and navigating services and systems, there's still so much fear there. So we've got a few cases just now where we've got everything in place to get some people the right support that they need, the mental health support, but there's an absolute fear there because these people are young parents and they're very afraid of what taking that step into, you know, officially admitting the trauma and what that might be feeling like, and as a new parent, and absolutely petrified. And I'm being told on this side by the professionals, it's fine, they're a priority because they've just had a baby, we will treat this way. And we just can't get them to make the step. And actually that one comes from the person first speaking to their GP, and the GP's first response was, do you have a social worker? Which put the fear of God into the young mother and made her backtrack straight away. And we're really trying, but even we can't. We a lot of the power we often hold in people's lives and being able to be a bridge to professionals, to services, and put ourselves on the line and say, listen, you can trust this SHINE worker, you can trust this service, they're good. But we're still hitting some real struggles and barriers there, and I'm dead interested in how we start to bring that down. How do we take
really
away
difficult.
The fear?
Well, you're not going to be able to.
I know.
And listen, I've got, like, I know I've got some wonderful social work colleagues who I would human clone in a heartbeat, because I know that they're so knowledgeable and so compassionate, etc. But there is a, there's just
a culture.
There's a culture that goes through, and I don't know how to change it. I've often, people often talk to me about community justice, and I say, I'm the prevention service. I like prevention. And I love health visiting. So health visits to me are amazing. So with your young mums, I would get your health visitor involved. I mean, they are so extraordinary. Can, you know, be the gateway into so many other services. And it's interesting. When I've dealt with families who are so, they don't like the police, they don't like social work, they don't like education, because you're there to talk about their kids that are not going to school. The people who can get through their doors is often health. And if you get someone good from health that can speak to someone and say, what is it you need? I'm here because people like health services, don't they? They want to be, because they want to be helped.
Everybody runs to the GP
absolutely.
For everything.
And we see, and I used to see it, and I've had to reflect on my experiences from a long time ago when I worked in emergency rooms, where I often used to get women who were often in addiction to drugs, but they would come to the emergency rooms with known specific pelvic pain. And would, you know, and I would speak to, like, sometimes a consultant, somebody would say, oh, they're just drug seeking. Now, we've realised, I suppose, over time, and of course it was always the case, so terrified of going to other services because they've got kids, don't want their kids taken away because they've got fearful, whether that's right or wrong, that they came to the emergency rooms because it was a place where they really needed help. And it's fascinating now that we're now looking at this through a different lens. But I still see women, predominantly women, I have to say, who are so fearful of contacting services because they're fearful of getting the services that they've had before, where people are pejorative, that they stigmatise, that you're almost having to, they make themselves small. I see it, I saw someone in a pharmacy the other day, they're coming in for a methadone prescription, and they made themselves small. And honestly, if they'd had a hat on, they'd have been doffing their hat. I'm thinking, but you deserve this. This is your right to. We have free prescriptions. We absolutely support people who are in addiction. And yet, we're not quite there yet. So we've got far to go. And we should be angry about it. Yeah. It's all right to be a bit angry and a bit angsty and think, oh, it shouldn't really be like that. You know, I'm going to change it. That's fine. But it is a really difficult one. And I don't know quite yet how we overcome that, but I do think when it's a more health related
I think you're absolutely right,
it's easier.
That's why we target, and the evidence shows the health inequalities for people with lived experience of complex trauma. But the services that they're not going to often are those basic health universal services, the dentist, the GP, following up on hospital appointments, and to know, like this young mum that we are supporting, the power that that GP had, how he could have set up that interaction so differently. If I was like, I need to get trauma training to this GP and more GPs, because you know when you just share that information, that knowledge with health professionals. I've trained dentists who have got really emotional actually once they've understood the links between poor oral. Poor dental hygiene and childhood sexual abuse, for example, having taken a very judgmental view on dental, you know, people's dental habits or why or not they'll come to the dentist. So there's absolute, I think, still a lot of knowledge to be shared with certain parts of the health sector. It's great that they're really starting to get on board with this now. We NES driving the trauma stuff that is happening, but actually there's still confusion in that space, because in a lot of the health world, the word trauma is still associated with physical trauma. Like, you know, all emergency services that are first on the scene, they'll talk about a physical trauma in that respect. So we're having to, even at a national level, make sure we put the word psychological in front of trauma to avoid any confusion there. But even, you know, doctors training, for example, they should have this in there from the start, and some do,
but I mean, so I look at the sheriffs. Now, this is where I never get invited to the Judicial Institute ever again, but they've changed.
Yeah.
I sat with the most fantastic sheriff down in Ayr, and I'm going to name him Sheriff Leslie. And honestly, I've got a cold, dead heart, obviously, having, you know, but I felt it was incredibly emotional. See, the way that he dealt with people, how he gave people dignity and respect, and he was in a position of power. Brilliant. And he knew that he had power to remove their liberty and everything else. And I said to him, it's like therapeutic jurisprudence, like he had this way about him. And it was pretty amazing. And he's not the only one. I'm not saying it's everywhere. But there is a real change happening. Lady Dorian, who talked about the sentencing of under 26s, that is actually making a difference. I can see and feel and touch it. Yeah. And it's really important. It's important for the health of Scotland as a nation. It is that we keep people out of the system as much as we can, and we recognise what has been done to them physically and psychologically, and sentence appropriately. That's not to say that we don't still have to send some people to prison.
Of course.
But actually, I see a bit of a sea change now. You know, I can't remember who said it was about devolution was like evolution, only it took longer. But, you know, it's not a political comment, but it's just that things sometimes take some time. But when it starts, it really starts. Mm. And that's a great thing.
Yeah. No, and we are seeing that as well. I was talking about that earlier this morning, about the difference that will make, the amount of young people no longer going to prison. God, my own brother died after coming out of a 3-month sentence that the judge had no other choice to give him. But if he was alive today and a young person, he would never have went to prison. Mm-hmm. He'd have got put on a, you know, diversion for prosecution programme. He would have, you know, get encouraged into employment, or, you know, it's very, very different, and that's dead exciting, actually. It's the evidence of trauma that's done that. It's absolutely about brain development and the impact of trauma, and the judiciary really listening to that and taking it into account now and their roles. And I think we need everybody and the kind of whole public sector to do that, to understand, because when you've got a population where 1 in 5 of the people have experienced complex trauma, mostly in early childhood, then...
Addiction, I think, has been one of the things, you know, we're having to think about, well, how do we do this differently? We're having to try and get the disruptive thoughts about what else could this look like?
Yeah.
Why is it we still have this level of people who lose their lives through addiction, or whose lives are blighted by addiction? What else can we do to support people into better well-being, or to prevent them getting there in the first place? And understanding trauma has been at the heart of that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's access to consistent approaches, isn't it? You know, just speaking there about if your brother had been here and had access to an alternative type of sentence or a diversion from that, whatever it might be, you know, again, there's such a drive for this. Scottish Government have a massive drive against, reduction in prison population, alternative to remand, but we don't see this kicking into action, unfortunately, and it really is a postcode lottery out there. Scottish communities are so diverse. There are different needs. And I suppose there has to be a strategic, there has to be leadership around the priority that there's access to alternative interventions that exist, because, again, we do an awful lot of talking.
I mean, I don't talk about alternatives to custody anymore. That's hackneyed for me. That just means people think about custody. I talk about community first.
Yeah.
Community first always. Mm-hmm. How do we keep people in their communities? How do we help them? If they have to do, you know, unpaid work, absolutely. How does that community benefit and, you know, allow people to repay their debt? Because I know that's a phrase. But then how do we connect them to services? How do we... You know, how do we keep them in the place where they are supported, where they have connections? Or how do we facilitate their move if moving's the right thing for them and they need to do it? Because I have had people who need to move out of their communities. For them
and we've,
to have a different
we've had
life.
A policy change on that. Where
indeed.
Now, and again, that's come from the push on and policies being trauma-informed, where now people can, you know, when I left Glasgow and moved out here, we had to do it, we were skint, and it took everything that me and my partner had, and it was really, really tough. We were really skint for a number of years, because everything we had went on the rent. And, you know, with that policy change now in place, so many people will not need to do that. They can apply for a social housing or a council house or an exchange in another local authority area and not have to be fleeing domestic abuse or going to look after a sick person, but actually can choose to move and restart and rebuild their lives. And it won't be the right thing for everybody. That's not to say that, you know, running, it's not about running away, but some people need to move on and move away from the where the trauma was, where the ghosts are.
And that was
my big thing, the pull factor. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Being able to get away from that is a human right. And if you've not got the financial capabilities to be able to do it independently, then God, it's terrible that we had that huge barrier in place. But again, an amazing step forward that's now been removed.
Yeah.
Absolutely huge. We're coming to, I think, a full hour that we've been gabbing for, and I'm sure we could go for another one. But I want to kind of finish up asking, what advice do you have for those out there who are just beginning their journey of looking at embedding lived experience? Because there are a lot of, you're an expert in this, Karen, even more than me, but there are a lot of organisations out there who are really just beginning to do this, who are beginning to truly ask the people that they serve for the first time in an authentic and meaningful way, what do you need and how do we do that better? And there's still a lot of fear and anxiety around opening up that lived experience box, that Pandora's box that it can often be. But one of the things we found through the Authentic Voice project was risk and safety being a big concern still for people. I know, my face goes like that, I know. People won't see this because it's not recorded, but our faces are squinting a bit here because, yeah, I'm not in that space, but I think it's my confidence as a practitioner and maybe my lived experience. But people who don't have necessarily similar lived experiences and have often done their role in a very different way, I think are a bit fearful about creating unsafe spaces, re-triggering people, all of that stuff. And I'm also experiencing a bit of professional anxiety about changing your role and sharing power and what that actually feels like in a professional capacity, because it can be quite unnerving for people who are not used to it. So what advice have you got for people starting that and who are feeling a bit like
I don't
that.
Know, there's nothing to be scared of. I will tell you, in the 20 odd years I've been doing this, I've never been let down. Never. The people who have got lived experience, and some have done some significant time in prison, I know their whole history. I recruit people who I don't know their history, who may not have been caught for other things. In many ways, and this is going to sound terrible, when I've taken on people with lived experience, they're so invested in it because it matters to them at a personal level. That it's a sort of head, heart and hand. They've been such integral parts of the team that I still know them 20 odd years later. It's not like they've just come in for a couple of years, got a bit of experience and gone elsewhere. They are wholly invested in it. And my leadership has been enhanced by their involvement. But it can be, I mean, the drive-by feedback can be harsh. And I think the temptation is not to go into the trenches. It's to sort of embrace it in its full stinging intensity and say, you know that, you might be right. You might be right. Can we just talk that through? But that, it's got to be a mindset. It's got to be a mindset. And listen, and it's not, I've had people who have been in recovery, who've gone into periods of relapse, and that's fine. Isn't it? It's fine that it's like everybody else, you know, we have people who experience mental health challenges and who take time off, and it's no different.
Physical.
It's a physical problem,
you know, health problems.
And I think that my own knowledge base has been enhanced so that when I go in and speak wherever, I hope I speak with an authenticity, you know, and bring usually people with me who can also speak about it. So it's, I don't know, it's, I've just never not done it.
Yeah.
So
It's in your DNA. Yeah.
That's it. If you cut me in half, it would have that prevention and sort of lived it. You know, I couldn't not do it. Mm. And if I can do it in the police, anybody can do it.
Yes.
Absolutely. I think a lot of the time from an organisational perspective, the fear comes from not wanting to get it wrong. and then we can overthink it. And so I think from our experience, what I would say is you need to manage expectations well, but you don't have to have it all figured out either. It's very much about that engagement process. It's relationship building. It is listening. And people can change their minds. That's one of the nicest things I think I've learned from conversations with you, Shamila. Yeah, the power in being able to change your mind as you learn and you evolve together. And back to that, you don't have to have it all figured out, but I think it's the commitment to where you're going and the acknowledgement about boundaries and expectations. And again, from an organisational point of view, you do need to give some forethought into asking, putting out all the questions. How are we going to look after people in this context? And again, if you didn't do it as well as you'd have liked to the first time, will you make sure you do it better the next time? It's a learning process. It needs resource, or it needs leadership. It needs not necessarily a new resource, but it needs attention. But absolutely, it's you're not going to find a more meaningful way to work. And as I say, it's back to systems and processes, and we can go there, but at the end of the day, it's about human beings and about connection. And if you go looking for that, I think you tend to find it.
Yeah, you're both absolutely right, I think, as well. And you both touched on leadership there, and I think it's absolutely key and essential. We find a lot of people, once they've got the right leadership, or they've got permission for leadership to go about this stuff, that can bring away a lot of the fear and anxieties. And usually the fear and anxiety does really come from a good intentioned place, but you know, you've both brought up, and we're just coming to the end there, but I can't even say this, but you've both brought up something for me there that I don't think gets talked about enough. And you said, Karen, it's in your bones, it's in your DNA. If we cut you open, we'd see it. I think we need to ask some questions about that, about who works in the sector in certain roles and why they first come into it. And, you know, because if you can start to change your thinking for fixer, rescuer mode, and you can get into that place about this is actually no about me fixing and saving the whole world. And that's a journey I've been on myself, because just naturally from my background, that's what I wanted to do. I was wanting to go and save every boy, like my brother, if you're ending up like him, but through the amazing mentors and learning I've had through all the amazing people that have been part of my journey, I've really realised, and that's what's allowed me to get my boundaries in check and look after my own well-being and my own self-care, because I know that, you know, that's not a healthy place to be in, but a lot of practitioners are still in that space.
Father Greg Boyle from Homeboy, and I've known Greg for a lot of years now, and he said, and I retweeted it out and I got some feedback about it. Not everybody was happy, and he said, I'm not a rescue service. I'm there for when people need help, and I'm attuned to when I see that they need help. And a lot of people were saying, you should be trying to rescue, but you can't. And I've had that learning experience. I've been so desperate to change someone's life, and they just didn't want it, weren't ready, or that I wasn't delivering them what they needed. And that has been a bit of a journey. It's been really upsetting at times. I've had people who have not survived their own personal journey. And it's a really difficult, difficult thing. And particularly as an ex-nurse, because I want to help everybody, but I've learned that I can't. And it's quite painful, but it's a really important thing, I think, for your own boundaries as well.
Yeah, and your own well-being.
And your own well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we finished off on a really poignant note there, and that's brilliant. I want to thank you both for coming along today and taking part in this podcast. I think people will really, in particular, enjoy this episode. Thank you both so very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Shamila.
Thank you for listening, and huge thanks to our guests. Please tune in to the next episode in this series.
You can find out more about this project from our website, www.authenticvoice.co.uk.
This was a collaboration between Safe Lives, Improvement Service, and Resilience Learning Partnership, produced by Bizon Productions.